come from. And if we face some sort of care deficit, then what we might need to do to increase the supply of care. And I'm doing this because I'm with Sophia Parker from Demos, running a project called Participative Public Services, looking at ways in which the people who we used to call clients or customers could become participants and investors in creating solutions for them, and how you could reshape services, and working very closely with In Control and Caroline's project. So, first of all, I think we've heard a bit about what is care. I think care is looking after someone's basic needs. Now, if you're doing that for someone who could do it for themselves, that probably means you're a servant. So I think there is something about care and desert that we have in mind, that we give people care when they can't do some important things for themselves. But if they could do it for themselves, then it's probably some different kind of relationship. But it's not just a question of meeting basic needs. The writer on creativity, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, says of creativity, to understand what creativity is, you must look at where it takes place. And if you understand where it takes place, then you'll understand what it is. In a way, care is like that, I think. If you understand where it takes place, you'll understand what it is. And what we've heard today is that although we may designate it as taking place in certain places, physical places, really it takes place in relationships. Care is fundamentally about relationships, about people having relationships. The better relationships you have, the better care you're likely to get. And so having good relationships is not just a route to care, but is actually, in some sense, I can think, constitutive of it. It's part of being cared for. And so if you're cared for in certain ways, I think, that also matters as well. Care is not an abstract thing, it's a very practical thing, it's a practice. And so there's a caring way to do things and there's an uncaring way to do things. So we can be careless in some circumstances. And so I think care, what we call care, generally involves being attentive, sensitive, and basically noticing when people need things. It involves being responsive, that is, not just noticing, but actually doing something about it when we notice, and making sure that what we think someone needs is in fact what they need. And it's also about being respectful, respecting a person, not just assuming that because they can't meet some of their needs, that means they can't meet any of their needs. And too often, I think what happens with care is that because we think someone can't meet some of their needs, we assume that they're completely incapable of meeting all of their needs, or in some sense, they're less of a person. So I think part of the way in which we think about care must take account then, as Martha Nussbaum argues, of people's capabilities, that they're capable of shaping decisions, having ambitions, very much as Caroline was talking about Joseph. So it's not just about basic needs, it's about relationships, practice, and about capabilities. And I did a project some time ago with Macmillan Cancer Relief. They were then called Macmillan Cancer Relief, they're now called Macmillan Cancer Support. And it was part of that kind of change of philosophy from relief to support that I was kind of part of helping them think through. And I did a series of workshops with cancer patients. And time again, what these people said was, don't see a condition, see a person. I'm fed up of being defined by cancer. I want to be seen as a person with cancer, not as a cancer attached to a person. And I think too often we do that, and taking care of someone is not the same as taking as caring for them. So whatever care is, it's not a quantum. It's not a lump. And so all this talk about care deficits is, I think, slightly alarming in a way, because it assumes that care is a kind of measurable, quantifiable thing that we haven't got enough of, and if we could simply increase its supply, then we would have a solution. Actually, care is a very qualitative, highly personalised, and very ambiguous thing. And finally, into all of that mix, I think there's an assumption that care is a bit like dolphins and green spaces. That's a good thing. So the more of it you have, the better off society must be. Whereas in some cases, and I think Caroline's story of Joseph draws this out, being able to do without care or services, being able to better cope on your own, being able to self-manage, self-provide, that might be a better solution for some people. So the assumption that care must be good and so the more of it we have, the better, might not be right if in some circumstances what people might want is to be able to self-manage better, to support themselves. And there's a sort of ambiguity in a lot of this talk about self-management, I think, which of course the best way to solve the care crisis is to redefine the demand as self-management, to redefine the demand rather than increase the supply. So if we have some kind of care deficit, and Wanless and other reports suggest, I think, that we do, and if it exists not just at old age but at young and for adults with distinctive needs, how could we close the gap? And I just want to talk through three basic approaches and what their relationship might be. The first, I think, is that care is compassion. So care without compassion or empathy, in some sense, is not really care. If someone discharges their caring duties in a kind of grudging or an unsympathetic way or an inattentive way, then we would regard it as incomplete or lacking in some sense. So to take care of someone, I think, really requires, as I said, to care about them, recognizing that something very important is at stake for someone who is important to you. And so from all that talk of compassion, it's really, of course, just a short step to George W. Bush and compassionate conservatism, because that account of care has a very long-standing conservative root, and it goes back at least to Edmund Burke, who, of course, criticized the French liberal egalitarian revolution for threatening to unpick the bonds of hierarchy and obligation, which feed a sense of loyalty and obligation, where the nobility is obliged to look after the lower classes, men for women. And so, in a sense, compassion and care are kept in place by social relations which are ordered and structured and traditional. David Cameron, of course, is running up against the problem that kind of account of the sources of compassion runs against the grain of a much more individualistic, flexible, mobile society in which people want a sense of agency and a strong sense of equal respect and rights. Well, if care mainly comes from compassion, how could we increase its supply? Well, you'd have to educate people, particularly boys, and actually men, and it would probably be a project of lifelong learning for a lot of men, to educate them in compassion. You'd have to make it much more central to education. Arts would play a really important role, because arts breed empathy, and so you would expect the Arts Council, the BBC and others to be majoring on works that in some sense stimulate, encourage, provoke questions about empathy. You would have to, over a long run, dramatically change the capacity of men to feel compassion. You'd have to have that as some sort of cultural target for society and measure it in some kind of way so you knew how well you were getting on. You'd have to perhaps increase the ability of those already prone to feeling compassion, mainly women, to increase their supply of it through time off work and so on and so forth. You'd have to build opportunities, as I think Neil was arguing and others this morning, for social connection and bridging social capital through volunteering, mentoring, social networks. So social networking, MySpace, Bebo and all the rest of it, I think has a dramatically bad social effect if it's just people networking with people very like them. What we don't have is social networks which bridge generations or geographies or classes, and maybe some of those are kind of things that we need. We heard about home share schemes and au pairs for the old. Maybe we should have sort of meet-up kind of schemes for elderly people and their peers and what have you. So in different ways, we'd have to celebrate, promote, encourage, foster compassion. Even if we could do any of that, compassion wouldn't be enough. Compassion as care will fall unequally on women rather than men. Women in that sandwich generation who've just got rid of their children and find that they then have to spend the next 15 years looking after their parents. Compassion can be fickle, fleeting, driven by the media, can suffer compassion fatigue very easily. It can also be highly paternalistic and parochial. It doesn't easily extend to strangers. Ironically, it was Adam Smith, not in the wealth of nations, but in the moral sentiments, who urged against compassion as a social virtue on the grounds that it was highly uneven. Immanuel Kant argued that to be the recipient of compassion was humiliating, might fill the compassion giver with a warm glow of goodness, but the loss of pride involved for those on the receiving end was often humiliating. Better perhaps to have a much more sort of Spartan ethic of self-reliance and disavowal of need. And of course, for some people, compassion is far too much. Don't give me compassion, just give me a hand. What I want is something practical. I don't want to feel your goodness helping me. I just want a helping hand. So I think compassion remains essential to care, absolutely essential, but it needs to be conditioned by other things. And as Martha Nussbaum puts it, it needs to be constantly educated by just institutions and rights. So the second basic account, I think, is that care should be seen as some kind of right, not as a source of source by compassion, but as a right, and in that sense it comes from justice, not the emotions, and it's probably guaranteed by the state and legislation and laws, not the family, which, as we've heard, is increasingly fraught and fragile. And equal concern for all is incompatible with special attachments to kith and kin, and so that's why we need equal rules brought in by the state. And so to increase the care supply in this kind of framework, we'd have to extend the rights that people might have to care and then fund them, as perhaps they do in Scandinavia and they're hoping to do in Scotland. But there are enormous problems with this approach, it seems to me, not just that people may be unwilling to pay additional taxes to fund it. In the 1970s, Ivan Illich's critique of all professionalised institutions, in which he focused on the medical profession and teaching, draws out some of this. Illich was fascinated by the tale of the Good Samaritan, and he argued that the tale of the Good Samaritan was absolutely pivotal in the development of modern morality, because it was an instance of where love became universal, not attached just to tribe or family, but was something that could be universal. And Illich's argument was that that then paved the way for the growth of institutionalized and systematized love in the form of care. And that became, in turn, a system of power, because then it could be denied or provided, determined by the professions who run those systems. And often those systems became counterproductive. The more care they gave, the more disabling they became. The more they helped people, the more the less able people became of coping for themselves. Charles Taylor, the Canadian philosopher, writing in a collection of Illich's last writings when Illich was dying of cancer and refused to have any medical treatment for the last 10 years of his life, had this enormous growth of cancer on his head. They produced a final collection of Illich's writings called Rivers from the North, and Charles Taylor wrote in the introduction that we live in a society which believes it should and it could relieve human suffering on a universal scale, but the very systems that we create to do that become quickly alienating, inhuman and degrading, and that is the problem that we face. Caroline Tomlinson's story of having 46 people coming into her house within 6 months is a little vignette of what living inside one of those systems is like. I did some work in Scotland on care in Scotland and the future of social care, and we spent some time with an old lady called Iris, who was largely incapable of looking after herself, needed huge amounts of support to live at home, and she had 4 separate occupational therapists, none of whom talked to any other occupational therapists. All of them were individually efficient, but none of it made any sense to Iris, and she had no idea why they were all coming. And her daughters, who were the only people who had any sense of how any of this might knit together, described it as a service blizzard. So a kind of blizzard of ill-coordinated service. Avishai Margali, who's an Israeli theorist of justice and decency, points out in his book, The Decent Society, that justice must be tempered by decency, that justice can be dispensed in an indecent way. And so alongside justice, we need a sense of decency and in compassion. So the problems with all of this approach, Caroline gestured at in her talk, is that service and rights actually become experienced as a gift, something you've got to be grateful for, that you earn permission for, from a state that forces you often into quite humiliating means tests and other procedures in order to get their kind of service. Or to paraphrase it, it's the people's money and the people will decide who is worthy of care and what the resources should be spent on. And I won't have any anaesthetic with that root canal treatment, please. But care isn't just about provision of rights and relationships. It's not just about meeting basic needs. It is, it has to be, as Caroline said, about recognising people's capabilities. So I think that the future of institutionalised care, state care, has to be increasingly participative, distributed, designed to encourage people to cope using and mobilising their own resources. The state has to see itself as a kind of platform on which other people can provide their solutions. And so just very crudely, it's always interesting going to China and seeing sort of playgrounds for old people in cities where people do exercises. And so we create platforms for children to do that, but actually very few for elderly people. So the third way of thinking about it, I think, is that care is really a commodity. Care isn't a right or a kind of compassion, it's really a commodity. Because care is mostly labour. It's about personal services. It's about boring, humdrum, repetitive physical things which aren't glamorous. They might be noble, but they're certainly hard work. And so people can't depend on their fragile families for that, and they don't want cumbersome, lumbering state services. So the argument here might be that the really big problem is that the care market hasn't developed as richly as it could, as, say, you know, the market for deodorants or holidays. We don't have the same kind of choice available. And so the best way forward here, then, might be to find ways to stimulate that market. So what might that mean? Well, you might have new care brands migrating through the generations with people, Virgin Old, to manage your care support. You might have new kinds of finances. Caroline gestured that if you can buy your DFS sofa interest-free, why can't you have more imaginative ways of funding your care in older life? And that might be linked to housing equity. You could imagine new kinds of care professionals and care workers, making it much more attractive. If you can get hundreds of thousands of students to work in Pret-a-Manger and Starbucks, how could you get that kind of same level of commitment to care and excitement about it? You might have new kinds of home technologies being provided by companies like Intel, Microsoft, Google and others. You could have housing deals that include care as part of the package, so social housing that doesn't just provide you with a house but a care over a lifetime. You could imagine villages of the kind Neil was talking about, modelled on, say, centre parks. My parents live in a village in Yorkshire called Grassington, which is pretty much like that, actually. 90% of the population are over the age of 65, and it's a fantastically vibrant, supportive, thriving community, but it must be pretty odd if you're 16, and you could imagine why you might want to leave. So you can imagine even more bizarre and extreme things. You could imagine, for instance, taking large numbers of people to countries that are quite warm with large, probably Catholic populations of young women, because those are the places that you're most likely to get good quality care, or alternatively you can import them, which is what we're doing at the moment. So the big issues with that kind of approach, of course, are inequality. Inequality of access, inequality in the workforce, and there's a deeper problem, which is that actually care isn't a commodity. And the idea that you might want innovation to bring the kind of business models of care down in cost to a way that people can afford them, well, if you're reluctant to trust your suitcase to EasyJet, why would you entrust your granny to EasyCare? I mean, at the end of the day, care isn't a commodity in a transaction. It depends on relationships. So what are the solutions, then, that I would recommend? I'm struck that one of the biggest failings of this government, despite its huge investment in public services and all the rest of it, one of its biggest failings is its basic failure to understand that instead of doing things to and for people, it needs to do things with people. and that public solutions work best when they mobilise lots of participation and social change. And so basically I think good solutions need public leadership and frameworks, they need lots of private innovation built on the top of that, but they need also huge participation in social change, norms and behaviour. And the more the state can design solutions that work that way, the better it will be. Because in many, many of our public goods now, whether it's health or care, and the two are intimately related, actually the public good is made up of millions and millions of private goods. And the job of the state has to be to try and shape individual choices to create collective outcomes. It cannot instruct them, it cannot impose them, it cannot just wish them out of existence. The job of government increasingly is shaping freedom and providing that shape. I'm very happy to be engaging with this, and I'd like to thank all the people at Demos who've helped me with reading and thoughts, because I grew up and went to university, did a course on politics and philosophy, where of course we read about social justice, and the idea was that rights and social justice were the way that society should be organised, and so we read Nozick and Rawls and Mill and Kant. And it was all about rights. The idea that actually society should be organised around something like care would have struck those political philosophers as fuzzy at best and sort of to do with things like emotions. And that was kind of not serious, hard stuff. What you needed was serious, hard stuff. Well, actually, I think care is serious, hard stuff. And actually, if we could elaborate a real care ethic at the heart of politics, not just as a sort of add-on, then it would mark a really significant change.